So whenever you have access to cheap green electricity, you can become an oil-producing nation.
Greetings, Earthlings, and welcome back to Earthlings 2.0, the show where we imagine how we can be better versions of ourselves and build a collective future we actually want to live in. Today's episode is a continuation of our exploration on how we can start displacing fossil fuels in our economy with renewable energy without having to replace all the vehicles and vessels and machines that we use today that run on that fuel. So our guest is from a startup that's at the forefront of using renewable energy, green hydrogen, and captured CO2 to create e-fuels and other synthetic chemicals. Their leadership has the potential to help us get to that coveted carbon neutral world. But before we teleport him to our metaphorical spaceship, I'm your host, Lisa Ann Pinkerton, before founding the award-winning PR firm Technica Communications and Women in Clean Tech and Sustainability, I was active reporting on energy, clean tech, and climate as an NPR environmental science reporter and also for PBS. And that makes Earthlings 2.0 the passion project for myself and the whole production team, really, to help us channel our enthusiasm and tamper our climate anxiety by being active and telling these amazing stories. So thank you to all of you who join us every week and listen to our shows. And welcome to all of you who are listening for the first time. I hope you enjoy what you're going to hear today. And if you do enjoy the show and you are finding it useful for yourself, I have a couple of requests of you. And you don't have to do all of them, although if you want to, that would be really cool, make you a power listener. But this is like a choose your own adventure for how to support the Earthlings 2.0 podcast. First, please take our listener survey. It'll take you less than 2 minutes. It's just a handful of questions, and the link is in the show notes. And that's going to help us better tailor the stories that we tell on the show to you, our audience. Second, you can sign up for our newsletter on Substack. So it's just not my mom that's getting these emails. Thanks, Mom, for being our newsletter member. We have a couple others on there too. But as she's so good at like liking every single post we put up on Instagram, she's thanks, Mom. Love you. But the newsletter is going to be once a month, so not very often. We won't spam you. And it's going to help you get a heads up on what shows are coming, what shows we put out, and then also what shows are related to a specific topic so you can binge listen or watch if you're on YouTube those episodes. And then finally, the third thing you can do, which will really help us grow the listenership, is the next time you're talking podcasts with your friends, would you consider mentioning Earthlings 2.0 and sending a link from our show in the app to your friend? That is going to be a huge help. And thank you to Resource Labs for having us on the network. Now, if you are around for Cleantech 1.0 or like to dive into your history, you might recall that in the early 2000s, there was this cleaner than coal fuel called natural gas that was touted as a bridge fuel that was going to help us buy some time while renewables matured. And that largely happened. New coal plants in the US eventually lost their economic validity. And that's simply because natural gas was cheaper. And then now you have renewables, which are even cheaper than that because you don't have to pay for the resource and go mine it all the time. Or in case of natural gas, use fracking and other methods to get that resource. So e-fuels is short for electrofuels or synthetic fuels. And today they hold that same opportunity to wean us off of fossil fuels and bring us at least to a carbon neutral experience, instead of waiting for things like electric or hydrogen transportation to mature. So quick 101 for you. E-fuels are produced by using renewable energy to generate green hydrogen through water and electrolysis. And then that hydrogen is combined with carbon dioxide that's captured from the atmosphere or from industrial processes like chemical plants. And what comes out of that is a liquid or gaseous fuel, like methane or methanol, or you can make synthetic gasoline or diesel or maybe even jet fuel. So there's a lot about e-fuels that make them attractive, like this idea of using existing oil and gas infrastructure to transport the fuel. The battle for that land has already been done, and those pipelines have already been laid. The infrastructure is there, so we can utilize it. Also, something we don't really get into in the interview, but I think is interesting, is that there's going to be more excess renewables on the grid as we build more renewable energy and as we're waiting for storage to scale up. And we don't want to, quote unquote, burn this off, or we don't want to sell it at a negative price because there's just an abundance of it on the grid. We can use that to make green hydrogen. And then some of that green hydrogen can go to electrofuels, e-fuels. And some of it might go to making green cement or other green steel and other high energy manufacturing processes in hard to abate sectors. So that's why we have Tim Biltkin as our galactic guest and e-fuels expert today. He's the founder and managing director of Enerotech, and we caught up with him from his office in Baden-Württemberg, Germany, where we first started chatting about the differences between biofuels and e-fuels.
So the major difference between the biofuels and the e-fuels are actually the way how they are synthesized. So the major share of biofuels today are biofuels of first generation. So you use crops, you use palm oil, so you use a feedstock, which is actually much better used in the food industry. So then there is the shift to a kind of like second or third generation biofuel, which again uses some input, which is either waste residues like cooking oils, waste oils, or even waste. But still here, the major problem is that these feedstocks for the biofuels, they are limited. So it's already clear that we will not have enough feedstock to replace all the fossil fuel what we are using today. So this is where the e-fuels come in, because the e-fuels, they use CO2 as a feedstock. And I think we can all agree that we have enough and actually too much CO2. So it's a perfect feedstock in certain requirements. And we can use renewable electricity to generate the green hydrogen. So in principle, you have the big chance to have an unlimited feedstock for the future to provide these gigantic masses of these fuels, what we will need to defossilize these sectors. So, and the fuels are currently in the ramp-up phase. They are to date not commercially available in large scale. And the big issue is here that the green hydrogen and also the feedstock as a CO2 is not available at scale at these sites. And this is where Enerotech comes into play. We have developed and commercialized a modular solution, and this solution can be implemented at the so-called sweet spots of the world. And the sweet spot is actually a spot where you have CO2 available at the right concentration, with the right source. So maybe it's biogenic, maybe it's even captured from the air, and where you have cheap green hydrogen, cheap electricity available, which is more or less somewhere where you have a lot of sunshine, where wind is blowing. And creating these, we call them oil fields of the future, is something what we are currently working on. So building up our modular technology, wherever we have the chance to build these or produce these fuels at lowest cost.
You mentioned that you see your technology as being sort of a leading solution, and you also talked about it being modular. So how about we start by explaining for our listeners, how are you doing this work differently than other companies that are out there?
The general conception of the industry, especially oil and gas industry, but also chemical industry, is the classical approach: economy of scale. Economy matters. The bigger you build it, the cheaper it gets, especially from the CapEx wise. So what the past 20 years have told us is that economy of scale is not so relevant when it comes to renewable energies. So we see modular wind parks, we see modular PV parks. They can go in the gigawatt scale, but they are built up of many, many wind turbines of many, many PV cells. We see the same trend now in the battery industry, where we are not building one large battery, but many, many small batteries. And the same trend is now continuing in fuel cells, electrolyzers, direct air capture units, where people standardize and mass produce a process. The first thing what we are doing now is we have developed a most compact, most efficient, very load flexible chemical reactor technology. And we can now, similar to these fuel cells and electrolyzers, standardize and mass produce these reactors. We are a factor of 100 times more compact than the conventional reactor technology. We are load flexible, and we can use them for different kinds of very exothermic or endothermic chemical reactions. So some are Fischer-Tropsch, methanol synthesis, reverse water gas shift, these classical thermochemical reactions, which are known actually to the industry for hundreds of years, but they have never been conducted in very modular scale. And now what we do is we have two, let's say, angles from how we achieve the lowest e-fuel production. So how we have seen how the past 20, 30 years, how renewables were scaled, we think that e-fuels will scale similarly. So we will go to these sites. They have cheap access to cheap green electricity. They start building up electrolyzers also on a very modular scale in the tens on hundreds of megawatts. And for each module that is built up, we can add our synthesis unit. And by that, we can actually stepwise increase our production capacity, replace the fossil crude. As long we can continue this, as long as the fossil fuels are still fed into the system, and by module after module we are replacing the fossil fuels, and we have quite high ambitions. So we want to synthesize an equivalent of 1 gigawatt until 2030, and this is actually doable with this modular business model, because you don't need to do this on one side only, but you can roll out your technology globally. So you can go to the sweet spots like Chile, Australia, US is a sweet spot, the Middle East, south of Europe. So everywhere on these sweet spots, we are already active. We have customers, and they can now actually buy our technology. We are a tech company, or together with these customers, we build, own, and operate our own technology and then sell the fuels. And this 1 gigawatt we are aiming for 2030 is approximately 125 million gallons of e-fuel per year. For us, that's a lot. It sounds a lot. But if we compare it, what we keep continuing to use on the fossil fuel, that's actually still a drop in the ocean. So we need to do everything really to start replacing the fossil oil now.
You mentioned combining it with other fuels. And in terms of the percentage of e-fuel versus fossil, so say you have a customer and they want to use your fuel. Are they using 100% e-fuel, or are they blending that with existing diesel or gasoline fuels?
It depends from customer to customer. So let's make the diesel analogy. So the diesel can be 100% used in existing ship engines. The diesel has also the quality EN5940, but it can be used 100% in an existing car. When you make the gasoline, you can make it ASTM compliant, so they can you can use it as 100% clean fuel, which means you still emit CO2. But the CO2 is captured before, so the fuel is called CO2 neutral. If it comes to aviation, planes, they cannot just stop on the right or on the left side when something is not right with the fuel. So the current ASTM standards, they allow to have a drop-in or blending ratio of up to 50%. But that's already a lot. And there are currently also works going on that test the 100% jet fuel in their turbines. And let me tell you, I mean, Aneratech was amongst one of the first or the first company that achieved the production of 100% ASTM compliant ESAF out of green electricity, green hydrogen, and even direct air captured CO2. We had it tested with a German aerospace engineering center. They did run a full analysis. They used it as 100% fuel in their turbines, and this worked.
So you mentioned captured CO2 and green hydrogen. Are there any other ingredients that go into making your e-fuels, or is that it?
It's the equation is always renewable electricity, green hydrogen, and CO2. You need some green electricity for running the unit, but I would say most, like 70-80% of the green electricity is used for generating the green hydrogen, and that's what you need. And out of it, you get like an e-fuel or a methanol, an alcohol, which is so clean. It has no sulfur in it. It has no poison. It even doesn't have like aromatics in it. So you can actually, it looks like water. So it's perfectly clean. It burns much, much cleaner than conventional fuels, because there are no unsaturated and cyclic hydrocarbons in it. So it's a perfect replacement for the fossil jet fuel, which is actually also responsible for the generation of clouds in high altitude, right? When you burn it and you have some particulate matter, then you have condensation, you have the forming of clouds, and they also, this indirect effect increases the global warming. So with using the e-fuels, you still burn it in high altitude. You are still releasing CO2 in the altitude, but you are burning the fuels much, much cleaner. It means you have less particulate matter, you have less formation of clouds. And you are decreasing at least the impact of burning the fuel in high altitude.
Attention, climate innovators, tech startups, and industry pioneers. Are you tired of waiting around for people to notice the cool stuff that you're doing? Startups tap award-winning clean tech PR firms like Technica Communications because it's still the most cost-effective way to scale their sales and investment pipeline. Whether you need better ways to talk about what you do, access to new markets, or simply gearing up for your next fundraise, Technica has you covered. For more information, visit technica.inc or visit us on LinkedIn. And hey, tell us if the Earthlings 2.0 podcast sent you.
Hey, listeners. This show is a part of the Resource Labs Network. It's a curated collective of industry leaders who are accelerating the clean energy transition. If you want to find out more, visit us at resourcelabs.co.
And you mentioned that you're using the CO2, it's captured at some type of emission source. And then once it's used in the airplane or the marine vessel or wherever, it's then being, there's then an emission component when it is used. So is the amount of carbon captured at the beginning to make the e-fuels, how does that equate to what is typically emitted when it is consumed?
So the equation is always, you have to see it, how you produce your e-fuels. And you now mentioned when the CO2 is captured. At the end, you have to make like a mass and energy balance. And then you can see how low your carbon footprint is, or how much the carbon intensity of your fuel is. And we have built like a fully integrated plant, which just uses electricity and water, and you produce hydrogen from the water. You use also the electricity to capture your CO2 out of the air, and then you have actually a closed unit. And a nice thing is these units, they also produce water, because in the combination of hydrogen and CO2, the oxygen molecule needs to be somewhere, so you produce water. You can use this water again to drive the electrolyzer, or even have a net plus water production unit. If you are at desertous regions or at very dry regions, that's very nice. So, but for that, the costs to date are still too high, because direct air capture is not there. This is why we focus actually on biogenic CO2. That's also no regret thing, because these biogenic sources, they will emit CO2 also in the future. You can go to breweries, you can go to biogas plants, sewage plants, and so on. What we are currently building is the largest e-fuel plant with a capacity of 10 megawatt in Frankfurt. It's not a global sweet spot, but it's a sweet spot in Germany because we have access to an electrolyzer that already produces hydrogen as a byproduct because the electrolyzer is operated for the production of chlorine in the chemical industry. And the hydrogen is currently used just in an energetic form. At the same site, there's one of the largest biogas plants in Germany. They produce biogas, they clean the biogas, they inject the methane into the grid, and the biogenic CO2 is currently just released into the atmosphere. It's an amazing spot. So we will use approximately 10,000 tons of CO2 for the production of 3,500 tons of e-fuel. So this is why you are asking, how much CO2 are you using? It's almost 100% CO2 neutral because you are using just renewable electricity and biogenic CO2. So the product carbon footprint is very, very low. And of course, when you burn it, you will release that amount of CO2 again. But at the same scale, you can leave the fossil fuel in the ground. And that at the end, together with electromobility, together with efficiency increases, will help to achieve the Paris climate goals, will achieve net zero. And in all global studies published to date, it's quite clear, it's said that without e-fuels, we will not achieve these goals.
If it's 100% e-fuels that are being burned when the fuel is consumed, if you're blending the fuel, obviously there's going to be higher carbon emissions because you're using fossil fuels at the end. But like you said, if it's 100% use case, then you're not tapping into those, you're displacing other fossil fuels that might have been used and you're not using those.
Exactly. And blending in is a huge opportunity because despite the fact that the fuels are today a bit higher than the fossil fuels, you are reducing the costs of the customer because you can start blending in something as low as 1 or 2%. So it doesn't have really an impact on the customer's money or on the end user's money. But on a global scale, you can see it's actually accelerating the use of these fuels. And there, I would say in maybe very short time, these e-fuels, due to the evolvement of the electrolyzers, due to the evolvement of the direct air capture unit, and the evolvement also of the synthesis units, these e-fuels will be cheaper than biofuels. And once this is the case, people will automatically switch to the e-fuels because the e-fuels have a much, much lower product carbon footprint than the biofuels. The biofuels, because they use like the carbon feedstock already, the plants, which needs to be transported, et cetera, they will always have a higher product carbon footprint than e-fuels. So once you are at this price parity, it's clear that e-fuels are the more favorable solution. Also, they have high quality, they are cleaner, and so on and so forth. And then let's see where the journey takes us. So if you make the calculation, if you believe what the electrolyzer companies are stating, and if you see how low we can go today with the electricity prices or electricity costs. So in some places of the world, we are already talking below $2 per kilowatt hour. If this trend continues, we will also be able to produce these fuels at costs maybe below $4 or $3.50 per gallon. So there will be the time. It's not today, it's not tomorrow, but the road is there and we need to keep investing in this technology. We need to build up this technology. And we are now at a phase where we have been in the 1990s with the renewable electricity.
Mm-hmm. I look back at what we call clean tech 1.0 is how some people like to refer to it. When solar was just picking up, Germany helped us a lot with some of your tax incentives back then to prove out the case for solar in a big way. And then, of course, China made their panels extremely cheap. Some people didn't like that, quote unquote, dumping the solar panels onto the global economy, but it certainly helped the faster adoption of solar energy. And I'm curious, I don't know that we can anticipate something similar with e-fuels, but how do you anticipate what's happening now with e-fuels and how that might scale?
It's exponentially. So, and what we see now, this global uptake of the installation, and yes, you're correct, there are always good and bad things happening. So the investment of China in the PV modules, it can be a good thing, especially for the Germans. They lost their entire industry, so they would say it was a bad thing, but it resulted in the case that PV is as cheap as it is today. It's cheaper than fossil fuels. And frankly speaking, for the entire world, it would be good if the same happens also to e-fuels, also to electrolyzers, because at the end, we need this exponential uptake of these fuels. And if you see how much renewable fuels we will need in 2050, which is in 25 years from now, it's actually nothing. We even need a stronger exponential growth of these synthetic hydrocarbons, of these carbon neutral fuels, even faster than solar and PV combined. So it's a huge, huge global task. And this is why it bothers me that we are still continuing to discuss the benefits and the drawbacks of e-fuels, and why are we not going just all electric, because electromobility has obviously the higher efficiency. But if you see the bigger picture and where you want to be in 25 years, it's really, ladies and gentlemen, we really should stop discussing now. We need to stop investing in fossils. We have to redirect all that money, that it really goes into climate technology. It has to go in electromobility and direct electrification, but also in indirect electrification, because otherwise this industry, what we have mentioned earlier, they will get in huge, huge troubles, and we will actually fail to achieve the goals. And that's probably bad for me still. It will be even worse for my children and the children of my children, but it's coming. So that's our motivation to stop that.
Yeah, we did an entire show called Life at 3C about, well, what happens if we miss all our goals? What will the world look like? And I think on some level, people still kind of look at you weird if you say, look, we're fighting for the existence, saving the existence of the human race. We're not here to save the planet. We're here to save humanity and civilization as we know it. And it's not that far away. Like, we really get a chance to move a little bit faster, much faster, if we're going to be serious about this. And you still kind of get a sideways glance from people, like you're being extremist to say something like that, when all the science is right there.
So I think that humanity is able to adapt, is also able to change, but not from today until tomorrow. And it's very difficult if you tell them you are not allowed to do something. So we know in the US, you drive like big cars. They can be smaller. They can be more efficient. I saw it now when the last time I traveled there, the airports are full. People fly. You don't have that many trains where you can go long distance with a train. So a lot of discussions we have here in Europe about, like, not allowing the people to fly inside a country is a valid point, because taking a train is much more efficient. But telling a US American you have to build up now an entire railway system until 2050 with high speed trains, so that you are not flying when you need to go from Houston to Indianapolis, or even worse, from New York to San Francisco. A bit tricky. And I don't think that also the politicians that are in favor of that will get the majority. So what we try to do is, we want to achieve that humanity can still have what they have accomplished today. I mean, traveling is a global right. It also helps to preserve the freedom. People like to fly into holiday. They want to experience different cultures. So this is why the flying and aviation is a very, very good example. So the critics that say, okay, Then let's just use it for aviation and not for the other sectors. I usually answer yes, but you cannot not just make pure e-fuel. Of course, you can maximize the output, you can maximize the yields, but at the end, you will still have other products which you need to use somehow. And so fighting that all sectors find a fight for carbon neutrality and that in all sectors, e-fuels are accepted as one solution amongst others is the right way to go, because then you enable also competition among technologies. Humanity will always, of course, go for the cheapest technology. You need to see that some technologies, especially electromobility, direct electrification, has already received a lot of subsidies. So that's also something you cannot compare it, but because also green hydrogen, e-fuels, they should have access to the same level of these subsidies. And then, I mean, the race is on. So whatever technology succeeds at the end is good for global humanity. We think it will be e-fuels. We think it will be the way how Enerotech is, of course, producing them. And but yeah, the future will tell.
What is the current reaction to the concept of e-fuels for your big oil, as we call them?
I think we are on the right track. So a couple of years back, nobody knew what e-fuel actually is. It was just a side effect, some homeopathic dose. Then there was a time when the people were laughing at you, like saying, "Ah, yeah, it's nice, but look how big the industry is and how do you want to disrupt it?" We are currently at the state where people, like everyone, tries to do it. The big oils, a lot of startups, a lot of hopes, a lot of hopium, but also the first, I would say, small flowers which are growing and they get some attention because it's nice. But still, when you have followed also the press releases, again, trying to fight for the fossil fuel, they say we will need it. We will still need it in the future. We should do everything what is like carbon neutral, but only when the technology is ripe for application. So,
and they get to choose when it's ripe.
Exactly. So it's an internal struggle. So it's perfect. It's perfect. Of course, everything can go faster. You can complain that the subsidies for the fossils are still too high. My take is we are at the perfect spot. We are at the perfect timing. The global oil players, they will not do it because they are just too large. They have their current investors. They are just too big to disrupt themselves. So, and it's the perfect chance to say, change is happening at the fringe. We are there. We built the first plants. People will buy it. People will pay a green premium. They will continue to do so. And the age of the fossil is really over. And we are now entering into a next era of mobility, which is carbon neutral with e-fuels. And let's see.
And I appreciate what you're saying, because I think people forget, like, the massive volume of all types of vehicles that are running on fossil fuels today. Like, we can't possibly replace enough of those fast enough with batteries or hydrogen fuel cells or whatever the case might be. We need something like e-fuels that is going to get us into a carbon neutral world, and then we can build from there. But right now, we just need to start continue to reduce our emissions and stop using as much fossil fuel as we are.
Exactly. We need all the solution. And as the challenge is so big, we cannot just be there and say the challenge is so big, let's do nothing. But actually, you have to say the challenge is so big, it's a huge, huge market opportunity. Because even as you mentioned, all the applications, direct electrification with batteries, fuel cells, so the direct usage of hydrogen, if they're all coming, still the e-fuel chunk is actually the biggest, because the entire world today runs on fossil fuels, which means on hydrocarbons. And if we are in the position to produce these hydrocarbons very efficiently in places of the world where you have a lot of sun, a lot of wind, you can synthesize them and transport them in a global infrastructure, it's also a business case. It's business cases for South America. It's business cases for Morocco, for North Africa, for, yeah, I mean, also for the Middle East states. They already have a lot of money from the fuel, from fossils, but they can even make more money from renewable fuels. So wherever, so whenever you have access to cheap green electricity, you can become an oil producing nation. It's a kind of like democratization of oils, because everyone who wants to use the electricity can do it. So I think we are here in a very global change. And if we direct it not only on the electricity, but even on the CO2, countries that consume a lot of these renewables, that produce a lot of these fuels, they will also consume, like, capture, like carbon capture and utilization of the CO2. So what happens is that the CO2 becomes a commodity. It is going back into the market. So you have a price tag on it. So countries that know how to deal with it or that use a lot, they can become a carbon sink. And I mean, if we look on a global scale where we say we just not have to reduce emissions, but we even have to do something with the emissions we have done so far. So the atmosphere is our global dump yard. So put a price tag on it, make a global system out of it. And once you get even paid for utilizing the CO2, it's amazing. So countries which have a lot of sunshine, which have a lot of wind, they can actually harvest their power much more.
Earthlings, this is another example of how distributed infrastructure, this time in the form of modular chemical plants for e-fuels, holds the potential to democratize the energy landscape around the world. I love what Tim said about how the generation of e-fuels could create new, quote unquote, oil nations where renewable energy is abundant. So these places where you have a desert, barren wasteland, can't really do anything with it. Well, there's a lot of sun there, and there's a huge potential to use that resource for the economic growth and stability of those regions. I just think it's really cool. And I think this can help us get closer to those Paris climate goals, and maybe even faster than waiting to transform our entire transportation infrastructure to electric or hydrogen. Now, obviously, there's going to be a role for those technologies as well. This is not a silver bullet, one size fits all type of experience. There's going to be different applications that work for different technologies, but I think e-fuels have the opportunity to support all of these different markets right now versus waiting. That's my point. Because frankly, we don't have a lot of time left. Ain't nobody got time for that. And so back to my point, if you think about it, Enerotech as an e-fuel technology can actually be a gateway for the renewable energy-powered chemical industry of the future. Pretty cool stuff. So keep your sensors pointed at Enerotech. I know we will. Our faith in humanity is restored this week by the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds and site manager Kate Hanley, who restored the internationally important Blanket Bog above the Dovestone Reservoir. That's in Manchester, England. It took around 5,000 years for this bog to develop and 200 years for it to degrade from things like acid rain and heavy grazing, leaving these vast, bare, eroded peat and deep gullies. So Kate and her local Manchester volunteers planted moss cuttings throughout the bog to rejuvenate it and enhance its water quality. Now, before they started doing this, this barren peat bog was incapable of filtering rainwater, which is the service that they provide as a natural phenomenon. And that was causing runoff and entering neighboring streams and causing the decline of overall water quality in the region. So Kate said they wanted to, quote, create a landscape that sequestered carbon and slowed floodwaters and also supports lots of biodiversity. And this is where that gives people really nice health and well-being benefits. Thank you, Kate, and the plethora of volunteers who donated over 45,000 hours of their time to plant these little tiny moss cuttings. You are reminding us that even things that take time and feel very tedious, like planting little cuttings, are worth doing on this beautiful blue-green space flower that we call home.